Hi, I'm Anne Strandchamps, and did you know that recently astronomers found something new in space? Something they can't explain.
It was, oh my gosh, that's bizarre. It was so weird that we thought it had to be a mistake.
This thing is a star.
It's called KIC 8462852.
It's 1,500 light years away, and a team of amateur planet hunters found it. And the weird thing about it is that this star is emitting strange light patterns. Penn State astronomer Jason Wright calls them dimming events.
It takes place over perhaps 10 days, that the star will slowly just get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, as though something large were slowly passing between us and the star, blocking part of the star's disk. And then over the course of several more days, it would slowly get brighter again as whatever was blocking the star moved out of the way and let all the starlight continue through. And we don't normally see stars do that, and that's got people pretty baffled.
And the thing is, whatever is orbiting this star and blocking its light has to be huge, like bigger than a planet. And Jason's come up with one possible explanation that's been turning quite a few heads. He says it could be a massive structure, a megastructure, created by, get this, an advanced alien civilization. And he's serious.
So, for a long time, people who do search for extraterrestrial intelligence have mused that alien intelligences might build gigantic structures, giant solar panels, perhaps giant telescopes, perhaps giant space stations. It is amazing, but we're trying to imagine what an alien civilization arbitrarily more advanced than us, it might be a billion years more advanced than us, could do. Now, I want to make sure that I clarify that we are still looking for totally natural explanations here.
But the problem is the only natural explanations they've come up with also seem pretty unlikely. For instance,
a giant swarm of giant dusty comets. And that recently a nearby star passed through this star's Oort cloud. We call it the Oort cloud, where all the comets hang out when they're not in the inner solar system, and triggered this huge swarm of enormous comets, much bigger than the comets that we see in the solar system.
So how exciting is this for you?
This is really exciting. It's great to have a really juicy mystery. And we were a little concerned that once we put it out there, we'd immediately get a phone call from someone telling us, oh, you missed this. This is obvious. We know what these things are. And no one's come forward with a better explanation than a giant swarm of giant comets, which means we've got a really good mystery on our hands.
Or an alien megastructure.
Could be. You gotta look.
Jason, thanks.
My pleasure.
Jason Wright is an astronomer at Penn State University. So today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're talking about the deep mysteries in our universe. Because for all the amazing discoveries that scientists have made in recent years, there are still all kinds of mysteries out there. From weird stars, to dark matter, to the origins of the Big Bang. And there's something kind of comforting about this. Theoretical physicist Alan Lightman actually likes living in an unknowable universe. In fact, he hopes we'll never be able to explain it all. Steve Paulson sat down with him recently to talk about learning to embrace mystery in science and in our own lives.
Alan, you straddle the line between science and the humanities, as very few people do. You're both a physicist and a novelist, and you've taught both subjects at MIT. Do you think your background in the arts gives you a perspective about the cosmos that's different from most other physicists?
I don't think it helps me any with my physics, but I do think that it helps me understand philosophically the discoveries of physics and the discoveries of science in general.
What are the questions that most physicists may not ask that come to you?
Well, I'm not really sure what most physicists ask themselves in private when they're alone in the middle of the night. I ask questions like, do good and evil exist at all in any absolute terms, or are they just constructions of the human mind? Why are we so bent on eternal youth when everything in nature is telling us that the world is temporary?
Now, you say that scientists will never know what created our universe. We'll always be looking for an underlying explanation, whether our universe somehow popped out of another universe, or why the laws of physics are the way they are. we will never get to that first cause. So there are certain fundamental aspects of this world, this cosmos that we live in, that seem to be beyond science.
Well, we of course have theories. We do have theories that explain how our universe came out of a fluctuation in the quantum foam, but we will never be able to know for sure. We will never be able to test those theories because we cannot get out of our universe to test them. We will never be able to go back to T equals zero to see exactly what happened.
Does that bother you, that there seems to be this fundamental mystery? At the core of physics, you might say that it would seem science will never be able to explain.
Well, it bothers me, but it's plausible. It only bothers me aesthetically because I wish that we didn't have to accept things that we can't prove. Of course, in the rest of life, there are many things that we accept that we can't prove. We can't prove why a particular character in a novel haunts us. We can't prove whether it's right or wrong to kill an enemy soldier in time of warfare. But when it comes to the physical universe, most scientists have always believed that we could prove everything that we believe. But there's no reason why nature has to make all of its parts accessible to us.
And yet, people seem to crave a sense of order that science might give us. As you put it in your book, the laws of nature protect us from the vagaries of the gods. The laws of nature satisfy a deep emotional need for order and reason and control. And yet, you're also saying that these laws will remain elusive and inexplicable.
Not all of the laws. Most of the laws that govern daily life are discoverable and can make very accurate predictions. It's just that some of the properties of our universe, such as the amount of dark energy, the strength of the nuclear force, we can't explain in terms of first principles. But given those properties, we can make very accurate predictions about whether an airplane will stay up in the air, for example, things like that.
Right. No, it's a philosophical question.
It's a philosophical question.
It's a question of how comfortable are we with some fundamental unknowability about our cosmos.
Yes. Yes, that's right. It's a philosophical question. And I think that most physicists would be at one end of the spectrum and being uncomfortable with the fact that we must accept some unknowables.
Well, it also sounds like you are comfortable living with mystery, with not knowing all the answers.
Yes. Definitely. One of my favorite things that Einstein said was that the greatest experience we can have is the mysterious. It lies at the cradle of true art and true science. And I think by saying that, Einstein didn't mean that the physical universe was unknowable. I think what he meant is that mystery provokes our curiosity. It provokes our imagination and stimulates us and stimulates our creativity and our search for meaning. That's what mystery is for me. It's the boundary between what we know and what we don't know. I hope that science will never have a complete explanation for everything in the physical universe.
Well, that's interesting. I think you stand apart from most scientists in that regard.
Well, there's still plenty to do as a scientist. I once interviewed a cosmologist named Martin Schmidt, who was the man who first discovered quasars, which are the most distant objects known in the universe. And Professor Schmidt said to me that at certain points in the history of science, when we are really confused by a new discovery, we can't understand it, we're confused by a new theoretical result that we can't explain or we don't understand, we're puzzled and stumped. He said those are the most exciting and interesting times to be in because that's when we're poised to make the most progress.
Well, speaking of the mysterious, you write about a remarkable experience you once had in Maine when you had an encounter with two young ospreys. Can you describe what happened?
Well, my wife is a painter, and every summer we spend on a little island in Maine. We have a cottage there. And there's an osprey's nest that's a couple hundred feet from the house. We can see it very clearly out of our front window. Every year for 15 years or so, the ospreys would conduct their family life there. And one summer I had been watching the babies as they grew from the beginning of June to mid-August. And I was watching them from the second floor of our house, which has a circular deck, an outside circular deck. And we sort of watched each other all summer long. And then, middle of August, the baby ospreys took their first flight, the first time they had left the nest all summer. They did one loop around the island, and then they headed straight for me as I stood on this circular deck. And by this time, these baby birds were pretty big, and these were young adult ospreys, so they were pretty big. And an osprey, not only is a big bird, but it has very powerful talons. It can rip you apart if it wants to. And these two birds were hitting at me with the speed of F-15s. I mean, they were coming at me really fast, and my first instinct was to run back into the house, but something made me stand there. And when the birds got within about 20 feet of my face, which is really, really close, they did a sudden acceleration upward and went up over me, over the top of the house, and off somewhere. And before they accelerated upward, for about a half a second, they made eye contact with me. And it was the most profound communication with a non-human that I've ever had. After they flew over me, I realized that I was shaking and I was in tears. And I realized that in that half second, they had said to me something like, this is what I felt, that we are brothers on this land, we share this land together. We've been watching you all summer, you've been watching us. We have a kinship, and we're all part of nature. That's the feeling I got in that half second of eye contact.
I assume it was terrifying, I mean, this experience. I mean, exhilarating, obviously, but also terrifying?
It was exhilarating and terrifying. They could have ripped my face off, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I somehow felt like they were friendly.
You write about this as, you say, it was one of the most profound moments in your life.
Yes, it was. And something totally unanalyzable by the methods of science.
So what do you do with an experience like that? I mean, how do you place it, if you try to, within the context of your life of trying to find meaning and all of that?
Well, to me, it's one of those precious, what I call transcendent experiences, where we realize that we're part of something much larger than ourselves. It's a precious moment, and I'm just grateful for it. We have very short lifetimes, 100 years or so, compared to eons of time before we were born and eons of time in the future. We're just a tiny sliver of existence, and we live on one tiny planet in a gargantuan cosmos. And so I think that any meaning, and meaning has to be found at the level of the individual, I think any meaning is in these precious transcendent experiences. You have to rejoice in it for what it is.
Alan Lightman is a theoretical physicist and a novelist. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Accidental Universe. So what do you think? Do you like that idea of living in a fundamentally unknowable universe? Or do you hope someday we figure it all out? Share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, a new experiment proves the theory that Einstein hated, quantum entanglement, or spooky action at a distance. Plus, a rare visit to the Isaac Newton archives in England. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of general relativity. That's something to celebrate. But you know, Einstein wasn't foolproof. In fact, there are some things he got wrong or just refused to accept. For instance, quantum entanglement. One of the most bizarre properties of subatomic particles is that they seem able to pair off and stay connected even when they're on opposite sides of the universe. Now, Einstein hated this whole idea. He called it spooky action at a distance. But just a couple of weeks ago, a team of scientists in the Netherlands seemed to prove it once and for all. So what exactly does it mean for two particles to be entangled? Science writer George Musser explains.
Yeah, I mean, the word sounds like they're like a ball of yarn, mm-hmm. and they're just kind of entangled, like a kindergartner's shoelaces can never be disentangled. But it's more subtle. It's more like a romantic entanglement, something that's an interesting but awkward relationship. And so these particles, as you say, that can come together, interact, and then separate again, retain this linkage, this bond.
One of the freakiest experiments I read about was, it's one somebody can demonstrate, I think people can even demonstrate it in the basement if you've got the right equipment, where you describe it as a kind of coin flip thing, except where you're flipping subatomic particles, and every time you flip them, the ones that are entangled, they both come out exactly the same, either heads or tails.
Exactly. So thinking of them as magic coins is really a very good way of doing this. And this goes back to a basic property of quantum mechanics in the quantum world, the subatomic strange world, is that it's random. So you measure the particle and it, say, might be this thing or that thing, 50-50. So it acts like a coin.
Heads or tails.
Exactly. So what's called heads or tails. So it means that if you flip the one on the left, it comes up heads, let's say. The one on the right comes up heads. You flip the one on the left, it comes up tails. The right one comes up tails.
Always? Forever?
Always. Yes.
And does it matter how far apart they are? I mean, does the effect get weaker with distance?
The effect does not weaken with distance. They could be a finger's width apart. They could be a planet width apart. They could be the entire universe apart. And they are still acting in synchrony. Isn't it weird?
It is. Well, frankly, it sounds like magic. I mean, something out of Harry Potter.
It's totally something like magic. In fact, it's actually, physicists have called it, this is the closest thing to magic that we know. Now, it's unlike Harry Potter. In fact, if Harry Potter did this, he'd fail his owls. Snape would throw him out of Hogwarts because the magic is extremely subtle. If you look on its own, just look at that one coin, you would just see heads or tails. It just looks like an ordinary coin. If you look at the other coin, heads, tails, ordinary coin. It's only when you compare them, you notice this kind of synchronicity that they have. So you couldn't use it to, apparate or do any of the things that they do in Harry Potter, because it's too subtle for that.
Hmm. You also tell a story about a guy who teaches at Colgate University, teaches college students, and manages to do this just in the college laboratory, right?
Enrique Galvis, who's up at Colgate, figured that actually the technology now is just good enough, and it's really coming out of the telecoms industry that uses fiber optics. It's coming out of DVD players that use lasers in them, and you can actually just repurpose those lasers for your experiments. You can kind of just salvage. You can go to the Best Buy and just buy a player and just take it apart and use the laser. Almost they do that almost literally.
Wait, are you saying that I could just go to Best Buy, get some equipment, and then entangle some subatomic particles in my basement?
You could. You could. I've actually done it, but not using Best Buy or DVD-grade lasers. I actually did it using gamma rays that I bought. I actually bought online. You can do this. Internet's an amazing thing. You can actually buy radioactive materials in very small quantities that they're safe online. And in some cases, the isotopes will actually give out entangled particles. So actually, I did that in my basement.
Wow.
So anyway, and Enrique did this, and he was really the first person to do it at the level of just, and a freshman could do it in college.
So there's another thing that makes this whole concept so hard to grasp, and that's the principle of non-locality. I mean, doesn't entanglement go against everything we think we know about how things in the physical world, real world things, interact with each other?
Exactly. So, example, a particle and another particle. The two particles are affecting each other. How do they do that? Our understanding of most of physics is they interact by sending a wave that passes from one to the other. Or maybe they just literally get up from one position and go to the other position and knock into the other particle. So they just make contact. Entanglement, quantum non-locality, violates this idea. These particles are somehow acting in a unified way despite the distance between them. In fact, they're insensitive to distance. That's what's weird. They're not acting spatially.
But is the corollary of that that space itself is an illusion?
Well, actually, yeah. That seems to be the thinking nowadays. I mean, so to you and me and to all of the creatures that inhabit space, space is quite real. The question is what's happening at a deeper level. And at a deeper level, space may not really be there. The distance may not really be there. So when we're apart from our loved ones, that's difficult, and there's a distance that separates us. But in a sense, we're actually not apart from them. There's no distance between us. We're still right together with one another.
So why have physicists been so reluctant to talk about quantum entanglement and non-locality? I mean, is it just that it just doesn't fit the rest of their science?
One thing is that there was an intense debate, really, in the late 20s, early 30s over the meaning of quantum theory. Everyone was engaged in Heisenberg, Bohr, Einstein, Schrödinger, all these great pioneers of quantum physics. But they kind of burned out on it, essentially. They got to a point where, like, oh, God, do we have to debate this anymore? Let's just do something with this theory. Let's apply it. So they started applying it to light. They started applying it to what later became known as the strong and weak nuclear force. So they essentially moved from this discussion mode, this philosophical mode, into more of a pragmatic mode. And then uses arose for it. People showed it could be used for cryptography. It could be used for aiding communications. It could be used for quantum computers, potentially.
Right. And as soon as anybody who uses a cell phone has reason to be grateful for quantum physics.
Exactly. And as soon as you show someone it's useful, you know, all their misgivings kind of become moot at that point.
Well, I'm still really fascinated about what it might tell us or suggest about the nature of reality that is maybe counterintuitive or not what we've been told. For instance, it makes me wonder what can be entangled. I mean, I'm made of particles, and those particles have subatomic particles, and so's my husband. Could my subatomic particles somehow be entangled with my husband's, even if he's far away?
Almost certainly, yes. In fact, almost certainly there are particles in your body that are entangled with some particles in his body. And there are particles in your body that are entangled with the car that you drive, with the kitchen.
So what about, remember when a lot of New Age thinkers began kind of jumping on the idea of entanglement to say, finally, there's scientific backing for telepathy and other psychic phenomena. Do they have a point?
You know, and a lot of scientists jumped on that bandwagon too in the 60s, let's say. But here's the thing. We need locality. We need the non-locality somehow to give rise to the space that we live in. And that's the space in which our consciousness, our brains, our minds inhabit as well. So there can't be psychic phenomena because connections have to essentially be broken to give rise to us. So we're kind of, it's kind of a catch-22 situation. You'd sure like to be able to tell the future or, you know, levitate or whatever, but to have those powers would mean that the very precondition of your own existence would be undermined.
So my last question, you've spent a lot of time thinking about and exploring all these ideas that we've been talking about. Has anything changed for you in sort of the way you see the nature of reality at a kind of felt sense?
I mean, I've always been struck my whole life by the weirdness of space. I mean, forget the phenomena that we deem to be, quote, weird, unquote, such as entanglement or dark energy or the Big Bang. Forget these huge mysteries and just think of the simple things in life, like space. How is it that we can stretch a measuring tape across a room? How is it that we can have a shape? So I think in working on this project, I came to really appreciate the simple things, the things that we don't think are mysteries but are. We don't know why the world is spatial, which is the most fundamental property that it has. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just like you don't have to jump to the mystery. You just look around you, and you will be led by the nose to the mystery. The mystery is just around us all the time.
George Musser is a contributing editor for Scientific American, and he's the author of a book about quantum physics. It's called Spooky Action at a Distance. So if you had to name the greatest figures in the history of science, Isaac Newton would be at the top of any list, right? When Steve Paulson was in Cambridge, England recently, where Newton worked for decades, he spent some time wandering around the university's ancient cobblestone streets and punting on the River Cam in search of the ghost of Isaac Newton.
Hi, I have a question for you. I'm doing a radio piece about Isaac Newton, you know, the famous scientist. Like, when you hear that name, what comes to mind?
The apple tree, yeah. Obviously, that he studied and taught at Trinity College, Cambridge.
So does he, like, of all the geniuses of Cambridge, does he seem like he's up near the top?
He's probably the first, if not the first. Obviously, we've got Stephen Hawking here as well, who you can see around town. But yeah, I'd say he's number one.
Well, there's a myth that he designed the mathematical bridge, and that it's a bit of a wives' tale, to be honest, that he, before it was rebuilt, it didn't have any nuts or bolts in it. The students took it apart because they didn't figure out how it was put together, and they then couldn't get it back together again, so they had to add the nuts and bolts. But the college has the first model of the bridge, and it's got nuts and bolts in it then, so it's a bit of a myth, really.
Do you guys talk about Newton in your tours
we
at
do.
All?
Yes. Obviously, the Trinity connection. I know he left Trinity after when the plague came into town, and then he came back. And yeah, his shadow looms large in Cambridge.
Okay, so maybe the tour guides just scratched the surface of Newton's presence in Cambridge. But if you really want to get a feel for Isaac Newton, the best way is to see his original manuscripts at the Cambridge University Library. Now, these are some of the most precious documents they have. They'd be worth tens of millions of dollars if they ever came up for auction. In fact, they're so rare and so valuable, it's hard even to get permission to look at them. They did let Steve in, but only in the company of four archivists, including one whose only job was to turn the pages, plus Newton historian Sarah Dry.
So, Sarah, why are you so interested? Why are you fascinated by Isaac Newton?
Well, Newton is the most important scientist who ever lived. Perhaps people might say Albert Einstein and Charles Darwin are in the running there, but I think it would be hard to argue that Newton is number one, and that's for the depth and revolutionary nature of what he discovered. He discovered a lot, but to put it succinctly, the three things that he is most famous for is his work in optics, in the nature of light and color, his work in mathematics, his invention or discovery of the calculus, and of course the incredible notion of universal gravitation, which was the crowning glory of his great masterwork, the Principia Mathematica.
And one of his radical ideas was that the laws of physics applied everywhere, not just here on Earth.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, Newton changed completely and forever the way we view our position in the universe, and he did it with what we're looking at in front of us, paper and pen.
Okay, so we should set the scene here. We're in the university library looking at two tables with various Newton manuscripts spread out. Where should we start?
Well, let's start with the smallest document here, which in some ways is the most surprising to me. I have to admit right now, I've never actually been in a room with these documents before.
You wrote a whole book about Newton's papers and you haven't seen them up close like this?
It's incredible. But the reason that I was able to do that is because of the incredible work done by people here, which has digitized, made available color images and transcriptions of nearly all of Newton's works. So I just wanted to say it's really quite incredible to be here, and I'm a bit overwhelmed to see, first, just the diversity of the sizes of the documents. So here's a document that I would say is maybe 5 inches tall by 3 inches wide. It's sometimes called the Trinity College Notebook, although there's a few manuscripts that can go by that name. On the front page of it, we see in a neat, careful student hand, it says Isaac Newton, Trin Col Cant, 1661. So that's an amazing thing to see, because that's the proud schoolboy, Isaac Newton, arrives at Cambridge. What he does in this notebook is quite incredible.
And there are drawings in here, diagrams, little
symbols. Well, what I want to point out is there's this line across the bottom here, and that represents the end of Newton's encounter with Aristotelianism. He draws a line, and underneath it, it says, Galileo saith that the apparent diameter of the stars of first magnitude is 5 degrees equals 300 equals 0.08333. And he is off and running. He's in the world of mathematics.
So he has basically discarded Aristotelian mathematics and science at this point, and we've entered the modern age.
I don't think it's too much to say that. It's quite incredible. And very soon, he's no longer referring to the works even of Galileo, but he's making his own experiments.
Fascinating.
Okay, so here we are with another early notebook that Newton probably started keeping in the late 1660s. He's no longer an undergraduate at Cambridge, but he's a Cambridge fellow. So if we can open it to the folio, just the first folio.
And I see you're very careful about how you open these documents.
Yes, you don't touch these documents any more than we need to. Now, This is wonderful. It's an early drawing of what became Newton's most famous experiment, his so-called crucial experiment, which is what he used to prove, as he saw it, that white light is made up of different colors.
No, he has a diagram here, a drawing.
He has a drawing, and he's labeled it very carefully. This is probably the earliest record of his thinking on this, so it's pretty special.
Wow. It's kind of remarkable just to be standing here looking at this.
It's not too much to say that these are some of the most important documents in our history.
Yeah. Okay.
And you can see his handwriting is quite clear. Oh, yeah, this is great, though. Yeah. The eyeball, I mean... So we're looking at possibly one of the most famous images from Newton's manuscripts. It's an image of his own eyeball. And we can see a hand that he's drawn holding a small stick called a bodkin. And this records an experiment which Newton did to test what effect the curvature of his own eyeball had on his perception of color.
Wait, how do we know this little drawing here is his own eyeball?
Because he says, I took a bodkin and put it betwixt my eye and the bone as near to the backside of my eye as I could.
It makes me kind of cringe a
little. Yes, and pressing my eye with the end of it so as to make the curvature in my eye, there appeared several white, dark, and colored circles. No kidding. So he's got this wooden object in his eye, and this shows you the extent of his intense scrutiny of the nature of vision, the nature of color. He's trying to understand, is color something that we generate somehow within our eyes, as many had previously thought, or is color something that's generated out there in the world as a result of the behavior of light? And he put his own body, his own eyeball at risk to do this, and indeed had to rest his eye for many days after this experiment, as one might expect.
Yes, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So this is a very big book. This is called the Waste Book. So here we can see sketches that Newton has made of Halley's Comet of 1682. He's sketching the location of the comet.
There are these various dots on the page here, presumably the various places in the sky where he's seen the comet.
He's indicated the stars. There's little asterisks labeled A, B, C, D, E, and F, etc. And then he's got the comet in there, and he's drawn the tail of the comet. He's drawn four versions of the comet as the comet shifted against the backdrop of the stars on four successive nights. And this is important because comets were a problem for accounts of celestial motion, because comets didn't behave like planets. They didn't seem to go round in circles. Looking at comets, thinking about comets, is one of the things that got Newton to universal gravitation, because he needed to account for the motion of the planets as well as the motion of comets.
So what are we looking at here?
Okay, so this is one of my favorite pages from all of Newton's manuscripts. It's a recipe for ink.
What does this say? To make excellent ink.
That's right. To make excellent ink, mix a half a pound of galls. Those are the blackened burrs that grow on oak trees, cut in pieces or grossly beaten. You add some gum arabic. You put them in a quart of strong beer or ale and let them stand for a month, stirring them now and then. At the end of the month, you put in some copperas. Too much makes the ink apt to turn yellow. You stir it and use it. He says at the end, with this ink made, I wrote this.
So this ink that we're looking at right now, he made it in his own lab. You'd think that he would have more important things to do than to write recipes on how to make ink.
On the other hand, understanding how chemistry worked was fundamental to who Newton was. He spent literally decades of his life working on chemical problems. In another sense, if we look around, what we're looking at today is a tiny fraction of what he wrote. He left 10 million words.
10 million words.
So he needed to be familiar with the mechanics of ink and paper.
Okay, which we look at next year.
Okay, well, I think we should do alchemy.
Mm-hmm, sure. Now, for the uninitiated, it will surprise a lot of people that Isaac Newton had any interest in alchemy. Alchemy is pseudoscience, right? Newton was the great founder of the Enlightenment, of rationality, the sort of the dawn of the scientific age. But he wrote a lot about alchemy, didn't he?
He spent years and decades studying alchemy, studying alchemical texts, performing alchemical experiments in his laboratory.
And this is the idea of turning base metals into gold or into something precious.
That is a big part of what alchemy is, although it was also, I think, for Newton, somewhat larger. It was about finding, understanding these secret vital forces that animated even the very minerals and chemicals that the earth is made up of.
But he was extremely guarded about who he told these experiments about or this writing, right? I mean, even back then, alchemy was considered a bit beyond the pale.
Yeah, especially back then. I think it's only very recently that scholars have begun to kind of rehabilitate alchemy and see it as part of a continuum with what is often called rational chemistry. And in fact, most of the alchemical documents are in fact not in this library, mm-hmm. Because they were culled out in the 19th century by scientists who were brought in to separate the science and the non-science.
Because a lot of people later on who realized what Newton was working at, I mean, all this vast collection of alchemical documents, for instance, I mean, they thought this was kind of embarrassing, right? They kind of wanted to keep that from public view because that would shatter the almighty reputation of the great Newton.
Well, the thing about the alchemy that's tricky is that almost nothing of Newton's original alchemical writings survive, if indeed there were. So there's nothing like a finished treatise that we have. The vast majority of the alchemical writings that survive, most of which are not here but are nearby in King's College, Cambridge, because interestingly, John Maynard Keynes ended up buying them at auction when they were sold in 1936.
John Maynard Keynes, the great economist, who was also an obsessive book collector and became obsessed in particular with Newton's papers on alchemy.
That's right. Keynes liked things that were hidden and coded and that only an elite could understand. I think he felt some sympathy with how he understood Newton to be.
Well, and there's a famous quote coming from Keynes in regards to Newton. He said that Newton was not the first man of science. He was the last of the magicians.
He wasn't the first of the moderns, but the last of the ancients. In different ways, ever since Newton has died, people have struggled to come to terms with the non-scientific work that he did, with the alchemy and the theology that he did. Oh, isn't it strange? Isn't it interesting? Isn't it revealing that our great man of science was also interested in occult or esoteric things? And in a way, it's an irony that Newton himself begat, because it's the very success of the Newtonian way of thinking about the world that banished from a kind of mainstream public discourse talk about mysterious and occult forces.
He had a mystical streak, isn't it fair to say?
I have a hard time saying he had a mystical streak. I think Newton was a systematizer. So he might have seen mystery on a surface, but he believed that he was the one who could uncover the truth beneath that.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Sarah Dry talked with Steve Paulson at Cambridge University Library. She's the author of The Newton Papers, The Strange and True Odyssey of Isaac Newton's Manuscripts. And one of the weirdest phenomena in the known universe has to be the comedic force known as Monty Python. Coming up, a conversation with filmmaker Terry Gilliam. I'm Anne Strange-Shamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI. Public Radio International. Forty years ago, Monty Python released the classic comedy Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the movie often listed as one of the funniest of all time. It was co-directed by the only American member of the troupe, Terry Gilliam. He went on to direct other award-winning films like Time Bandits, Brazil, and 12 Monkeys. And now, on the eve of his 75th birthday, he's released an illustrated memoir called Gilliam-esque. Doug Gordon caught up with him.
Terry, the cover of your new book, Gilliam-esque, is suitably Gilliam-esque. There's a photo of your head with the top sliced open, and there are all these animated figures popping out, including, of course, the famous Monty Python foot. And it says on the cover that the book is a pre-posthumous memoir. What does that mean?
Correct.
Why?
Because it's just an honest statement. It's very simple. I'm not dead yet. And that's about it. The publisher said, oh, but shouldn't that be preposterous? No, it's preposthumous.
Yeah, but it has to do with this whole thing that happened last month with Variety, right?
No. We had the book all published and finished long before Variety killed me.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the fact that Variety killed me, they were obviously just jumping on the bandwagon. They wanted to be there.
Okay, my mistake. And I wondered how that could have happened with it so close to the publication date. Okay, thank you for clarifying that. So tell me about how Variety killed you.
Well, I had been in France with my wife, came back, and discovered I had been dead. actually, by the time I learned about it, I had already been resurrected. But there were those missing hours that I didn't realize that I was experiencing the afterlife. I just thought it was another boring airplane flight. That's the afterlife for me. Somebody, and it's not really been explained to me, how somebody at Variety pushed the button that triggered the headline that said, Monty Python's Terry Gilliam, director of Brazil, dead at XXX. And below that was my obituary. But somebody did that. And I don't know if whether they had seen an ad or some reference to my pre-posthumous memoir and jumped the gun, because this happened just, in fact, the book had come out in England. There's another odd thing, because it said dies at XXX, because they hadn't obviously put the date in yet. But XXX is 30. Yeah, it's 30. And the day before was the 30th anniversary of Brazil in America. That's what's very odd.
Oh, yeah.
So there are forces at work that we do not understand.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting. And I responded to it saying, you know, that I had died from so many bad reviews from Variety.
Yeah, and then a lot of Twitter, there were a lot of tweets with Python references that people,
of course,
made. Like Variety has downgraded Terry Gilliam from dead to merely a flesh wound, and Terry Gilliam is not dead. He's resting. He's stunned. He's pining for the fjords.
The whole thing was just incredibly funny and perfectly timed, I thought, for the promotion of this book.
Yeah, it's perfect. Did this whole really surreal experience change the way you viewed your life and your impending demise, which we hope is still many years away? Decades even.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the interesting thing is when my wife and I started having children, she suddenly became aware of her own mortality. And she never thought about her death before. And I said, I've thought about my death every day. What I do, maybe it's because, you know, keep your enemies close.
Yeah.
So hold death close to your chest and it won't happen.
Sure.
On the other hand, it's like laughing at death, because I've decided death has no sense of humor. So the more you laugh at it, maybe the longer it'll stay at bay.
Yeah. That's a good attitude. The title of your book is Gilliamesque. How would you define Gilliamesque?
I don't know. I mean, this is always about when people talk about my films, oh, they understand exactly. That's very Gilliamesque. It's your style, blah, blah, blah. I honestly don't know what they're talking about, because I just do what I want to do. I do what inspires me or excites me at any moment. And I never try to analyze what I do. I don't want to know. I like to keep the whole process, even for myself, slightly mysterious, and just go with the flow when it's flowing.
And thank you for saying process, because I'm Canadian, and as you maybe have been able to tell, in the process down here really drives me nuts. So that's great.
Process?
Yeah, process. I know. It's process. But I would think that one of the most difficult creative challenges you faced in your career was making this move from being this one-man operation, creating animation for Python, and then moving from that into what's, you know, this really isolated work you're doing, into what's probably the most collaborative art form there is, film directing. How did you make this transition?
It began by directing Holy Grail and then realizing I don't want to direct the Pythons ever again.
Why not?
At that point, I wasn't particularly good at verbalizing exactly what I wanted and why it was needed to be done in that way. And they were impatient, because they just wanted to get on and do the jokes. And I was doing more complicated things, making the sketches work, trying to create this world, the real world of the Middle Ages. And I realized, no, that's not going to work. But when I did Jabberwocky the first on my own, it was that moment when I'm working with these terrific actors, these great famous comedians, and I, as the director, would say, do this, and they did it without arguing. Whoa, this is amazing. This is kind of fun. And so it started rather easily. The technical side of it, I just seemed to know how to do it. I just seemed to be quite easy. And communicating ideas to the technical people was easy. And in a sense, it was a nice change from, one could argue, the loneliness of the long-distance animator.
I like that. That's great. That could have been an alternate title, not as good as Gilliamesque. That would make it, that'll be the sequel. You got to write a sequel,
right,
the memoir.
You.
That's great. I love that. One of the other big creative challenges you faced was moving from the two-dimensional world of animation to the three-dimensional world of live-action films. How did you pull that off?
I was surprised that I have this really good spatial sense just on that level. I can see things in 3D, even though I was working in 2D on the animation. It was easy. That's what bothers me. There's a certain thing that happens. It's happened several times in my life. It's like when I, before Python started, I learned to airbrush using the airbrush. And nobody ever taught me. I just saw Robert Grossman was a very good airbrush artist in America in the 60s. And I said, oh, I'll try to do that. And I taught myself. Almost everything I know how to do, I taught myself. I didn't go to school. And yeah. It's always surprised me. It always reminds me of it's like a musician who will pick up, say, a trumpet and just start playing it. And I've been lucky in that sense. So now I learned I get better. Or maybe, no. Quite often, it's just the opposite. I start with some kind of innate ability, which I lose the longer I start doing whatever I'm doing. So now I have no idea how you direct a movie.
It's interesting. I was struck by the fact that you said it's easy. That's what bothers me. So are you saying then, do you think that art should be more of a struggle? Has it not been enough of a struggle for you?
Yeah, but you put your finger on it, because I had this romantic idea of sort of a 19th century artist in a garret starving to death, that you had to suffer for your art.
Yeah.
And I was raised by parents who didn't abuse me. I wasn't a member of any oppressed minority. I wasn't a woman. I wasn't gay. I wasn't starving. And so I thought, what chance do I have as an artist? That's when I moved to New York and started working on the pain element.
Yeah. You've made a lot of great films like Time Thanks. Bandits, Brazil, The Fisher King and 12 Monkeys, and many others. Is that there's something that a unifying factor, something that you think all your films have in common?
I don't know. I mean, I think on many of them, at least, there is that battle between fantasy and reality. There is that. How far can your imagination take you before reality runs over you? There's clearly a sense of anti-authoritarian attitude in there. And there's also, in many ways, the innocence of a child, the pure way they see the world. They see the world more honestly. It's either a child or a lunatic is like that, so they tend to be in the films.
Yeah, you say that your films have always been repositories of idealism, and I think when you're a child, that's one of the times when idealism really runs high, and you tend to be more idealistic. And then as you get older, reality kind of bashes it out of you.
I think the other problem, too, for me is where childhood and youth is all about so much to explore, so much to learn, so much to discover, all the vast world that's out there that you don't know. So there's all of that that you're aspiring to knowing more about. And as you get older, it goes the opposite direction. I'm not surprised anymore. I know too much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That is depressing when you see humanity repeats the same mistakes, the same stupidity goes on and on. It's like, as a species, we don't seem to be very good at learning.
Yeah. You say that one of the main misunderstandings of your films comes from the kind of trailer speak where the man with the deep voice says, "We're going into the mind of Terry Gilliam."
Yeah.
You add, that's the last place you want to be, and that's the reason you make films, so you don't have to be stuck in your own mind. And it makes me wonder, raises the question in my mind, what's wrong with being in the mind of Terry Gilliam? It seems to me it's a very imaginative, interesting, and fascinating place to be.
Only when I'm making a movie or talking on the radio about my life. The reality, as my wife will attest to, is miserable. I'm a grouch. I'm a grump. I'm a curmudgeon. I don't speak when I'm at home. I grouse around the place.
I find that hard to believe, but I'll take you at your word. If you want a bad place to be, you should try being inside my head. That's a house of horrors.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's bad. It's bad. I was surprised to learn that you created an idea for a theme park attraction, an idea for an attraction called the Body Ride. Can you tell me about that?
Well, years ago in Britain, somebody had the bright idea of doing a kind of British Disneyland. And they asked me to do the Body Ride. It was going to start with a great bowl of soup, it looked like, and you'd get in pea pods and hollowed out corn cobs and carrots. You would ride the food in to a great big mouth with chomping teeth and then be sucked down into the gut. you're going to have to deal with antacid pills being dropped down trying to stop things, and you probably escaped into the bloodstream, and we know where the ride ended, don't we?
I think we did. You don't need to say.
It didn't happen, but at least this last year we've had, in Britain, dismal land, Banksy.
Yeah, with Banksy. Well, I was going to say, maybe it's time for a Terry Gilliam theme park, like we could call it, I don't know, Gilliam Land? What do you think?
Well,
what would that look like? What would a Terry Gilliam theme park look like?
Well, I'd just have to steal from all my films. I'd steal from myself is how it would work. It'd be wonderful, but it's not going to happen, so I don't spend too much time dreaming of these things. That's what impressed me about Dismal Land, because I'm a huge Banksy fan. I think he's just wondrous.
He's downright Banksyan, isn't he?
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Banks-esque. I'm Banksy-esque. Banksy-esque.
That rolls off the tongue better, yes.
Yeah, we'll keep the esque thing going for the day.
Terry Gilliam is the author of Gilliam-esque. He talked with Doug Gordon. That was a very Gordon-esque interview. By the way, this is music from the soundtrack to Gilliam's 1985 movie, Brazil. That's it for our show today, but don't worry, there's more in our podcast feed. Get your fix by looking us up on iTunes or Stitcher. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.